I think that the experience that people love most about coming to Crystal Cove now is that it's very simple. It's very, very, very simple. When you drive down that little road that takes you into Crystal Cove and you leave behind Fashion Island and the Newport Villas up above and the gated communities, and you come to Crystal Cove, you are stepping back in time.
Welcome to Stories of the Coast. I'm your host, Robin Pressman. This program celebrates the 40th anniversary of Proposition 20, the California ballot initiative that voters passed on November 7, 1972. It was written by Peter Douglas, who became the first coastal commissioner. 4 years later, Governor Jerry Brown signed the Coastal Act into law. As a result, the California coastline is considered the public's land. The beaches and bluffs are open to the public, and miles of oceanfront land and views have been protected from private development. In this episode, we take a trip to Crystal Cove State Park in Orange County. Crystal Cove is a historic beachfront community of hand-built cottages, originally built by squatters in the 1930s on land owned by the Irvine Company. It survived as a private enclave for dozens of families until State Parks bought the land in 1979. Residents were allowed to remain for another 15 years, but in 1995, the state signed a secret deal with a hotel developer to convert the cottages into an exclusive luxury resort. But thanks to the vision of one former resident who organized statewide support for preserving and restoring the cottages, Crystal Cove survives today as the last example of authentic early California beach culture. More importantly, it's affordable and fully open to the public. This is a story about one woman who fought to protect her home, even when she knew it would never be her home again.
My name's Laura Davick. I'm the founder of the Crystal Cove Alliance, and I grew up at Crystal Cove. My family's been there since 1937, and my parents fell in love there, and they acquired cottage number 2 when I was a year old, so I've virtually been there for the past 53 years. Well, you know, I often slept on the front patio at night, so getting up in the morning, I would, you know, run down to the beach and go down to the tide pools, and I'd run up the hill and get my horse and ride up and down that beach. It was just the best backyard any child could have ever had growing up.
Although the Cove was originally part of the historic Irvine Ranch, it was Hollywood that first discovered Crystal Cove. With its broad sandy beach and tranquil bay, it made the perfect setting for early silent films and movies like The Sea Wolf, Treasure Island, and Beaches.
There were lots of films that were made there in the teens and 20s. This was before the cottages were there. And the reason that Crystal Cove was so desirable was because they could create a South Sea feeling without ever leaving California. And then some of the film sets were left up, one or two evolved into a cottage, and then families started coming down and erecting these one-room cabins on the beach. But, you know, you have to remember back then, Pacific Coast Highway didn't go in until 1927. And so that was really what opened up people coming down to that area. And this was all, you know, unbeknownst to the Irvine Company. So as these squatters basically continued building in these cottages, soon there were 46 of them dotting the coastline there. And so the Irvine Company sent out this letter saying that if you would like to move your cottage, you may, but if you do not, from this point forward, we're going to be charging you a land lease to remain here. So if you were in, you were in at that point, and you had a lease. It wasn't a long-term lease, but those were the families that were the fortunate ones that were able to live at Crystal Cove.
For the next several decades, the families that made up the Crystal Cove community enjoyed an idyllic, carefree, and yet exclusive lifestyle. The geography of the cove, as well as the gate across the road, ensured total privacy for the residents. Behind the gates, cove culture included luau parties, fireworks displays, bonfires, grunion hunts, and saluting the martini flag hoisted at 4 o'clock on Saturdays to mark the official start of happy hour. Kovites built a yacht club out of hatch covers and driftwood and even printed up mock membership cards. Residents created unique personas for their eclectic cottages, which they christened with names like Whistlestop, Pearl Harbor, and the Tilton Hilton.
There were never any property lines at Crystal Cove, and so people just built where they wanted to. And there was no permission, no permitting, no cities to go through, nothing like that. So these cottages truly just evolved, oftentimes using materials that were found other places. Sometimes things that washed up on the beach were used. There was a large wooden schooner that washed ashore, I believe it was 1927, and some of the wood off of that schooner was used on the North Beach cottages. There's one cottage that, you know, has sinks from the Del Coronado Hotel and windows from an old railroad. And so it's just an eclectic source of materials.
But in 1979, the Irvine Company sold the property to the state. In an attempt to preserve their unique community, residents had the foresight to get Crystal Cove included on the National Register of Historic Places just a few months before the property changed hands. The designation protected the structures, but not the people who lived in them. When the beach beneath the cottages became public property, the residents' days there were numbered.
And so at that point, it started to change. You know, it was originally this small little community where there was a gate and it was very private, and, you know, people didn't dare to come in because they just didn't feel that they were, you know, welcome there. And then the gates came down and it became open to the public. And so then the rules started. And so then there was no more riding horses on the beach. And then there was no more fire rings or fires on the beach. Then fireworks were against rules and regs. So slowly it changed. And during that time, we continued living there with our cottage. And we were just grateful to be able to still, you know, remain there. But nonetheless, our time was clearly up. We, as residents, were under more and more pressure to move.
The yacht club was torn down, alcohol was banned, and the proud martini flag waved no more. Residents worked out a series of agreements with the state that allowed them to stay in their cottages temporarily while sharing the beach with the public. In return, they gave up any future relocation assistance. In this way, they were able to remain for another 15 years. But in 1995, they started hearing about a new luxury resort that would change the face of Crystal Cove forever. 5 years earlier, behind closed doors, State Parks had signed a 60-year contract with a hotel developer to transform the cottages into a luxury resort. Nobody knew about the deal until men in suits started showing up at the Cove. When suspicious residents asked them what was going on, they were shocked at the answer.
The plan consisted of converting the 46 cottages into 73 units, putting in 3 swimming pools, a 100-seat restaurant, valet parking, and I assure you it never would have been the same. But the primary concern was that the room rates were going to be $375 to $700 per night. So clearly creating a very private and a very commercialized enterprise. It was a dangerous precedent for the state park system to give away park land like that.
Laura Davick started organizing public workshops to educate the community about the resort plan. She spoke at city council meetings, coastal commission hearings, and at the Parks and Recreation Commission. Anywhere and everywhere they would let her talk about Crystal Cove, she would go.
People were always interested in knowing what was happening down at Crystal Cove, so I always felt like I had an audience. And they were also surprised by the fact that this contract existed and that they weren't aware of it. It was unknown to the community what the resort plan was going to entail, and that we were so close to losing it. And in fact, it had been lost. The contract was signed. This was a done deal. This was not just some plan that was being discussed. And there were other environmental organizations that were involved and were passionate about doing similar work. Everybody had a different vision for Crystal Cove, but we decided that in order to be really united and be strong, we just needed to fight the resort. And so that was what we all kind of coalesced around, was getting that resort stopped.
But Davick soon learned that the power of no only goes so far. In the process of fighting the resort, she discovered the inherent power of positive message. In this case, a better vision for Crystal Cove's future.
I had a different vision for what Crystal Cove could be. And I first I felt that if it was going to be open to the public, it needed to be affordable. But I also felt that because Crystal Cove was so unique that it really shouldn't be just converted into a hotel, that it should become a world-class facility that included some very important educational venues. I had amassed this huge collection of historic information as well as photographs, oral histories. So in my mind, those stories needed to be told and that information needed to be part of what people would experience when they would come to Crystal Cove, rather than some, you know, varnished version of what the cottages were like.
But some of Davik's neighbors didn't share her vision. They formed a homeowners association and sued state parks in an attempt to keep their homes. Davik saw it as a lost cause and publicly recused herself from the lawsuit. Instead, she founded a nonprofit organization, the Alliance to Rescue Crystal Cove, and continued her crusade.
When I formed the organization, I realized that Crystal Cove was about to be lost. I was still living there, but I really knew our time was up. It was a new era. There was no way that the state was going to allow us to continue on. And so my vision really shifted. And although I was still a resident, I let it be known to everyone that this was not about saving my cottage. This was about saving all the cottages, and it was about creating the next Crystal Cove. So for me, it was much different. But for all the families that were there, you know, it was a very difficult time because they had been cottages that they had had in their family for generation after generation. And it was difficult personally for me at that time because some of the people, you know, that lived there felt that I was, you know, on the other side. But nonetheless, our time was clearly up. And so I wanted to make sure that Crystal Cove was going to remain authentic.
But vision and a nickel will get you a gumball. The state of California had signed a legally binding contract with a developer to build a resort. Unwinding that deal seemed far-fetched at best. Park staffers had their marching orders from Sacramento. So the state decided to host a public meeting to sell the plan to the community. But they underestimated their audience.
The real turning point for Crystal Cove was January of 2001 at Lincoln Elementary School, and I'll never forget that evening. There were about 800 people there in the room, and State Parks had come down with the resort developer to present this resort plan to the community. And there were tables out in front with signs that said no resort, and you know, people were holding signs, and it was just a wonderful demonstration of a community pulling together to really say, not on our watch, not at Crystal Cove. This plan is not wanted. And then when the resort developer tried, and I underscore, tried to get up and talk about his plan, no one would listen. Then we had a series of people giving public comments. There were probably 30 or 40 people that stood up and talked about why this was such a bad idea. And so from that point forward, I knew that night when I pulled out of that parking lot, that plan was dead. It was not going forward. I could just tell it was just like the wind had shifted.
Ironically, the cottages at Crystal Cove that people fought so hard to save could never be built on the coast of California today. Some are directly on the sand, others are perched on the edge of the bluff. It's precisely the type of development that the Coastal Act was created to prevent. And yet, Davik found an avid supporter in Coastal Commission Executive Director Peter Douglas. Unbeknownst to Davik, he did more than just share her public vision for Crystal Cove. He played a key role behind the scenes in convincing the would-be developers to drop their plans for a high-end resort.
It would have been a colossal giveaway of public resource. So we told them they couldn't do it. They'd have to change the Coastal Act and get the plans changed, and we were going to vigorously fight that. I made it very clear to them that if they wanted to go that way, they'd have to go through me, and I was going to fight this thing to the end because it needed to be open to the public. It's a crown jewel on the coast. They knew how serious we were, And they didn't want a public fight because they would lose that public fight. The public clearly was on our side. So they cut their losses. Said, okay, if we can't have it our way, give us some money, buy us out, and we'll get out of your hair.
About a week after the infamous meeting, I received a call from the Coastal Conservancy, and they explained that they might have $2 million to buy out the developer's contract. The meeting was down in Laguna, and everyone, all the folks that were involved in working on trying to stop this were there, and their board unanimously approved providing $2 million to buy out the developer's contract. So at that point, we were kind of back to square one, if you will. Developer was gone, resort contract was gone, and it was then time to try and figure out what to do with the cottages at Crystal Cove. The cottages were still being lived in at that point. The residents were still there. We ended up leaving that year. So this would have been around February of 01, and the residents moved out in July.
With cottages finally vacant, the process of planning for Crystal Cove's future began. Suggestions ran the gamut from tearing all the cottages down to converting them all to overnight rentals. Davik's vision included some overnight rentals, but also a marine research facility, classrooms, and an artist-in-residence program. She envisioned a museum where visitors could immerse themselves in the cove's culture and history and listen to her recordings of former residents telling stories about the old days. Ultimately, her vision prevailed.
And I really felt that if people were coming to Crystal Cove, whether it be for an hour, an overnight, or a week, that they should be able to become really submerged in all of the many things that make Crystal Cove so unique and so special. So through that planning process, the plan that evolved was approved by the Park and Rec Commission and also the Coastal Commission in 2003. So then, of course, we had this great plan and there was no money. And so the Alliance to Rescue Crystal Cove, which I had formed in 1999, now transitioned into the Crystal Cove Alliance. And their focus shifted from rescue to restoration, if you will.
Proposition 40 came to the rescue with $9.2 million in state bond funds, which paid for the restoration of the first 22 cottages. The Alliance raised another $6.7 million in private donations for Phase 2, the research and education facilities, as well as significant infrastructure. Now, the restored cottages are almost always fully booked, and there's a popular restaurant where the old soda fountain used to be. All of it is managed by the Crystal Cove Alliance in cooperation with state parks, a unique operating agreement that's becoming a model for management elsewhere in the state park system.
So now having Phase 2 behind us, we have simply one remaining phase, and that's the North Beach area. 17 cottages on the North Beach, estimated at approximately $20 million. And we're currently focused on that. So that will more than double the amount of rentals that we have now. Needless to say, it's a huge project.
There is no question that if I look at the California coast and all of the places where activists made a difference, Crystal Cove, it stands right at the top of the list. There's people like Laura Davik, Susan Jordan, and some others who just got in the way of the bulldozers and said, we're not going to let you come through here. This is the people's asset. And now when you see what they've done to restore that historic treasure, it's just amazing. I've been down there now so many times, and there are people walking around from Ohio, Middle America, with their jaws hanging down. And that just warms my heart. So hats off to the activists.
As far as being an activist, I didn't even really know what an activist was. But I will tell you that when you are passionate about something and protecting something, there is no ends that you will go to make sure that something is protected. And, you know, I kind of think back on how I felt about those 46 cottages and how I still feel. I mean, I feel like kind of like a mother with her kittens, you know. It's like I'm very, very protective of what happens down there.
It was an education Davik wasn't looking for, but one she doesn't regret.
Well, this is what I learned. I learned that you never, ever take no for an answer, because I can't tell you how many times people said no to me. But you just have to keep pushing forward. And, you know, there's the old saying, you can't eat the entire elephant all at once. And so you just have to eat it one bite at a time. And so, you know, every little step was a victory. And, you know, now looking back over the past, you know, 14 years or whatever it's been, you know, I think had I seen the magnitude of how much work this was going to be, I may have maybe chosen another path. But nonetheless, I have this huge sense of purpose in my life. And I have this huge challenge to complete this project and to see it to the end.
Now, instead of living at Crystal Cove, Davik goes to work there every day in a bluff-top cottage that's been converted into an office. She's furnished all of the cottages with a mixture of original items donated by former owners and period pieces from garage sales and thrift stores, but her memories of growing up on the beach are never far from her mind.
That experience as a child, I am quite sure, is what motivates a lot of us to choose the paths we choose as adults. And I can only tell you that being at Crystal Cove and that experience I had as a child inspired me to preserve Crystal Cove, because the coast is never saved, it's always being saved. And the same thing for state parks. Parks are never saved, they're always being saved. But truly, just because it's in a state park doesn't mean it's safe.
This program was produced in honor of the 40th anniversary of the passage of Proposition 20, the California ballot initiative that voters passed on November 7, 1972. It was written and researched by Sarah Christie and produced by Robin Pressman and Mark Fuller at KRCB Public Radio in Santa Rosa in association with Uniglass and Coastwalk California. Our theme music was written and performed by Mickey Hart. I'm your host, Robin Pressman. More information is available at coastwalk.org. Coastwalk, saving the coast one step at a time.